Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. Today, I've got the great pleasure to be in the garden with Chris Baines, a leading environmentalist, but also an author, landscape architect, naturalist and TV presenter. I first met Chris when he interviewed me for the Landscape Architecture Postgrad Diploma at Birmingham. That would be some 48 years ago, when he was already making quite large ripples in the gardening world. He made the first wildlife garden at Chelsea in 85. He presented and made the TV programme Blue Tits and Bumblebees, co-founded the Urban Wildlife Group, and was one of the first Countryfile presenters. You've done loads more than that, Chris. Obviously, that's just a tiny, tiny synopsis. But you did make a big impression on your students. I remember it now. We were a very mixed bag. We were planners, engineers, architects, and the odd horticulturist graduate like me. But your lectures did keep us spellbound. They were inspirational and delivered with a practical but very committed enthusiasm. And back in the 70s, that was all really groundbreaking stuff. What was it, having started off on leaving school, that got you on this journey?
Well, I grew up in Sheffield, and my mum and dad were great gardeners, passionate about the countryside as well. And I lived on the, we lived between Sheffield and the Peak District. And while I was there, from the age of about three, I was actually born in the middle of the city, but moved to the edge, and when we moved there, it was a village. My dad taught in the village school, and over the next 15 years, I guess, my entire green space landscape was built on. And I didn't think about it particularly at the time. It was a great place to be a kid, you know, lots of building materials on the building sites. It was soon after the end of the war, so it was lots of overgrown allotments. You know, the landscape was a fantastic place to grow up in. But looking back, that must have been pretty formative for me, actually, just seeing the cricket field that was opposite got built on, the army camp down the road that was derelict turned into a housing estate. That was where I'd always pick my blackberries as a kid, you know. So that was one of the elements, I think. And then the other thing was that Sheffield has always been a hotbed of revolution, really. So that's where the great mass trespass went from, that opened up the Peak District and the national parks emerged from all of that. And my grandfather was an engineer, but he was a watercolour painter and, again, passionate about the countryside. So from a very early age, I was immersed in nature, landscape, the countryside. And then my mum particularly was just a really talented gardener. I always say she could strike roots on a chair leg. You know, she was just always propagating things, and they were passionate about alpines. And so, at about the age of 10 or 12, I suppose, my mum and I started selling rockery plants at the front gate. So even at that stage, I was growing things, and I suppose it was a combination of wanting nature to survive, loving the sound of birds and the wildflowers and things, but at the same time seeing how much it was being damaged even then by urban expansion. And now, looking back, of course, what was happening then was it was the beginning of a whole change in the way that farming was taking place.
Yeah, absolutely. But you then went on to join the Parks Department, is that right, before you did your horticulture degree at Y?
Yeah, I had a pretty grim school record, really. Failed more things than I passed. But nevertheless, I managed to get into the University of London.
So why, just back on that, why did you have it? Because I thought with a teacher for a dad, you'd have been disciplined. You are very disciplined, we all know that.
I was disciplined quite often, actually, at school.
Were you a very naughty boy? Was that what it
was? No, I was. It was a five-class entry school, grammar school.
Yeah.
And I was in the middle class. And I just think we were victims in that process. If you were very bright, you got very good teachers. If you were very thick, you got very good teachers. If you were in the middle, actually, you got whatever was left. Mm. I mean, I remember I had four different teachers of physics in one year. I had a history teacher who was hopeless. And I love history, but they failed completely to kindle any kind of interest in it.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the more satisfying things for me has been that having failed English language and failed English literature to then win the National Book Prize for conservation writing, I thought, well, there you go. You know, perhaps I was right and they were wrong.
Well, you and me too. I failed it too, but I never won that award. But there we are. Fascinating. So then you went to join the Parks Department.
I went into the Parks Department because I had to do a year before I went to Y. That was not just me.
See.
That wasn't everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, that was everybody.
Yeah.
And the only kind of horticulture I was familiar with really was urban parks. And so I got a job with Sheffield Parks, and it was very memorable. It taught me such a huge amount, because it was at the very end of the great era of parks, really. My first day's work was in a park, Millhouses Park, and at that stage there was a head park keeper who did nothing but sat in his hut and supervised a tier upon tier of gardeners, and I was the oik right down at the bottom. And on my very first day, I managed to write off a lawnmower, I remember, because they'd showed me how to start it and how to drive it, but they hadn't shown me how to stop it, and I finished up in the river with it, which was memorable.
Boy racer with his mower, right, Chris?
But it was also the year when the World Cup was 66, and I was working on the parks. Sheffield was one of the places that was a venue for the World Cup. And one of my jobs, I often think about it now, was that because I was new and young, I had the job of watering the hanging baskets in the high street in Sheffield, which involved standing on top of a set of stepladders on the back of a lorry with a watering can, being driven down the street and watering the hanging baskets. And I just think, God, clearly health and safety had not at that stage been invented. But I worked in lots of bits of Sheffield. I worked on the city centre team for quite a long time and had a really instructive first day with the guy who'd run that gang for ages. And he just made a very important point. He said, you're in the public eye here. He said, so you never know who's driving around the traffic island you're looking after. So when you're working, you have to really work hard, look brilliant. But I'll now show you where all the cafes are in Sheffield, where we can hide a wheelbarrow and a set of tools and disappear. So just lots of those kinds of lessons, which I then went into landscape contracting, and I was managing people who knew all of those tricks. So I loved that year, actually. I really loved getting to know Sheffield. It was at the time of the folk music revolution, and Sheffield was at the epicentre of that, so I was singing in folk clubs at night and that kind of thing. So I had a great year before I went to university.
Yeah, I love my year out too, working on all different aspects of horticulture. You pick up so much, and it's nice being on that bottom tier, partly because you know it's only for a year, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
But we're here in your garden, which I have to say, it's lovely to see it, because I've seen this in books. I remember you showing slides of this when we were students. And I gave my dad a copy of your How to Make a Wildlife Garden. Is that the correct title? Which has been in print from 84, is it, right the way to the present day. It's always in print. And I gave it to my dad. And my dad, I don't think he'd done any gardening before I gave him the book. He was, you know, he's a fanatical squash player, tennis player, golfer, businessman. But I gave him your garden and he did the exact same. He put a huge pool, wildlife pool, in his front garden, which not many people do they? Walking along this road, I was interested to see how many people had copied you, because it really does look beautiful. Probably 2/3 of the garden is covered with water. And there's lots of native type plants, but it is pepped up, isn't it? There's not sort of nettles and docks. It looks beautifully tended, but it looks very rich.
It's one of the myths, really. There are there shouldn't be any nettles or docks in the garden. There is actually a water dock plant down by the pond, which I quite like, which is very statuesque and produces a great seed crop in the autumn. But I'm a gardener, you know, I'm a horticulturalist originally. So I'm interested in whether I can turn my little patch into a kind of oasis in the surrounding landscape.
Yes.
And then somewhere that really does celebrate the changing seasons. And so it's a spring garden, because lots of our native wildflowers are spring plants. So lots of primroses at the moment. And if you were here in another 2 or 3 weeks, the perfume of the bluebells in the garden would be captivating, because it's very enclosed, it's very sheltered. But it, as you say, it's got lots of horticultural cultivars and things in it as well. So I always grow wallflowers, for instance. I always grow tobacco plants in the summer. And the bulbs that I'm growing, apart from the bluebells, none of them are native. So the crocuses are from the east of the Mediterranean. And it's that mixture of native plants, some of which are exquisite. The garden fairly soon will turn pink because pink campion will flower everywhere in it. But in amongst the pink campion, there'll be honesty flowers as well, and lots of forget-me-nots. And then, you know, the whole year is a celebration, really, of the changing seasons.
So pink campion is interesting because I do find it quite invasive. So presumably you keep up control of yours. You weed some out.
Yes. I mean, you can see that there isn't really much open space for anything to colonise in the garden. And I think one of the things, we've lived here for 30-odd years now, what's interesting is that these things ebb and flow.
Yeah.
So there have been years when the whole front garden has been blue with forget-me-nots. This year, there'll be relatively few of them. And there are other years when the pink campion completely dominates, and then that will back off a bit. So, I mean, I'm... It's not exactly laissez-faire because I do go in and, you know, I dig out the dandelions. I was digging out the dandelions the other day that have come in because I don't want yellow flowers in the middle of my pink. Good heavens, that would be appalling. But there's not a lot of intensive horticulture going on, but there is a lot of celebration of the variety. And I'm always thrilled when, you know, the first of the primroses flowers, or there are snake's head fritillaries. The first one came out yesterday under the tree there.
Yeah, ours have just come out. They are just wonderful, aren't they?
And they're another native plant, you see. Yeah. Which people, I think many people have not quite woken up to the fact that we actually do have very beautiful native wildflowers.
Well, your Daphne miseria by your gate. Now that is phenomenal, isn't it? And it doesn't flower maybe as much as Jacqueline Bellure or one like that, but it does still flower for quite a long
period. It has the most wonderful perfume.
Yeah,
and it's native, and it grows when I was a student down in Kent, I used to wander through the woods on the North Downs, and there were lots of spindle trees, native spindles, with those amazing pink seeds in the orange, or is it the other way around? Really weird looking things.
Yeah,
and then there was Daphne miserium. And it's just a lovely plant. It's right by the front gate, so when it's flowering, the perfume is you know, you pick it up the minute you walk through the gate. And it's one of the things that I've really focused on in the garden. It's a small garden, so there are lots of perfume things here. So in the hedge at the side, there's holly and yew, but growing through all of it, there's a native honeysuckle, which really flowers for 2 months, I suppose, through the summer. And in the evenings, it just fills the garden with perfume.
So in 85, you did the first ever wildlife garden at Chelsea. And I remember seeing that. What medal did the RHS give you for it?
Well, they gave me, I think, a silver flora, I think. So somewhere way down in the system. But, I mean, it was really intriguing because, you know how the system works. The judges walk round and they were...
Men in bowler hats.
Yeah.
99% of them.
Every garden at Chelsea at that time, really, was awe-inspiring but untouchable. You know, everything was bigger and bolder than you could ever achieve in your garden. Giant this and giant that. And then my little garden. And they were completely wrong-footed by it. They did not know what to make of it. And when I got my medal, came through the post afterwards, instead of it saying for a wildlife garden, it says on the back of it to J.C. Baines for his wildfire garden. Because the RHS just
couldn't get their heads
around the idea that you could have wildlife and garden in the same sentence. And I remember the very first day, you've done Chelsea Gardens, you know, you inherit a piece of football pitch, really. My piece of football pitch had a white line corner flag position on it, I remember. And it was completely perfect grass. So my first day was spent going around all the other gardeners, digging up their daisies and transplanting and swapping bits of my daisy-free turf for their daisies. So by the end of the day, everybody knew there was this nutcase down the end of the row that was creating garden. But the public response was just fantastic. I spent every minute of every day at Chelsea on the garden. And in most of the gardens, people were silent. You know, they were awestruck. So they weren't talking about it. They were just taking in these amazing displays. When they got to my garden, it was deafening. Everybody was talking about, they've got honesty in their garden, didn't realise it was good for wildlife. I remember I had a big pot of broad beans right at the front, which were flowering. And I could hear people saying, well, they look like broad beans, but they can't possibly be broad beans. You know? But broad beans are fantastic for bees.
And they're beautiful.
Yeah, and they're beautiful. And they smell wonderful, actually. The flowers smell glorious. So it was a real showstopper in many ways.
But now, you see, it just reminds me of Sarah Raven, because the RHS, when they saw Sarah use orange next to purple, they said, goodness me, we couldn't give you a higher medal because of the colour combinations, but now they're all over Sarah Raven, and now they're all over you, aren't they? You've just had to move them on a bit, didn't you, really?
Well, and the nice thing about the book is that this is a fourth edition that's come out recently, but it's now published as the RHS Companion to Wildlife Gardening. So 40 years from not even being able to get the word out to actually having it as one of their kind of classic gardening books is very satisfying.
Oh, it's lovely. I often hear you on Radio 4's Tweet of the Day, and I think that's lovely, and I'm always intrigued by that. So do you decide which birds? I notice you nearly always record birds that you have in your garden, don't you? And do you do the recording from here?
Yeah.
And you do it yourself, and then you send it
Well,
in,
the actual bird song is recorded, is a BBC recording.
Oh,
so,
right.
So that's the way it works, and and they recycle them as well. So I get emails from people saying, "I heard you talking about the woodpecker in Tweet of the Day." Well, that's probably the 10th time that particular Tweet of the Day has been on. That's the only time they got up at 6 a.m. to hear it.
But they let you choose the birds you want
absolutely.
To do, because it's so much nicer, I think, to hear British birds. You often get the sort of purple spotted beaker from Malawi or something, and it's not as so much interest to me as the blackbird and the thrush are my favourites.
Well, originally it was all native birds, and David Attenborough was going to be doing a lot of them, and did.
Yeah.
And I think everybody thought this would be a kind of 20-week wonder.
Yeah, I thought
but
so.
But then actually it
Such
proved to be so popular.
Yeah.
And it's so short, so it's not a great imposition on the network, is it? And so that's why it's now become a kind of worldwide festival of birdsong. And I agree with you. I mean, interesting to know that there is some strange beekeeper down in, you know, southern Spain that sings like this. But actually, just having people celebrate song thrushes. I mean, the song thrush here is just spectacular every morning.
Yeah.
And just being able to say, well, they're easy to identify because there's the one bird that always repeats itself. And you just say that to people, and then when they hear this bird that is repeating every phrase, and they know it's a song thrush, that's really satisfying. And one of the great things that I'm really proud of is that I started International Dawn Chorus Day. For my 40th birthday, I wanted to see lots of friends, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to. They're all over the place. So I wrote to them all and said, look, I'm going to get up at 4 a.m. on my birthday and listen to the dawn chorus. It'd be really nice.
When is your birthday? What day?
Beginning of May.
Beginning
4th
of May.
So
that's the time we listen to the dawn chorus.
So the first Sunday in
May
now. That happened to be a Sunday. The first Sunday in May is International Dawn Chorus Day. And so I said, it'd be nice to think that friends were also out wherever they were listening to the dawn chorus at the same time.
Lovely.
Nice idea.
Yeah.
And the second year, when people have said that was really, really great. Whether they actually got up at 4 a.m, I never know. But
just opened the window.
Yeah, something like that.
Turn the radio.
Get back
off.
Into bed.
Yeah.
So the second year, I contacted the Today programme and just said, you may not realise this, but the first Sunday in May is National Dawn Chorus Day. And of course, if the Radio 4 Today programme says it is, then it is. So they announced this thing. And then, within a year or two, I'd had various foreign friends. There was a woman who won the Wildlife Photographer of the Year Award from Denver. And she came and stayed with us. And went back, and they set up 3 events on International Dawn Chorus Day, which it then became international, in parks. And they made a real effort to get people with disabilities out into the park on that morning by 4 or 5 in the morning so they could hear the birdsong. Now, it's quite extraordinary. I've been involved with the programme that RTE in Ireland produce each year, which is a live outside broadcast. It's 8 hours long. It starts in India. It travels all the way from India with as the birds wake up, as the sun follows, then another voice from another country will chime in and start talking about the birds you're hearing in Turkey or Israel or Italy or wherever.
Yeah.
And just so satisfying. And I always said, you don't need to know what they are. You don't need to be able to name them. Just listen. If you really want to make an effort, then close your eyes and count the different ones you hear. And then you'll begin to hear that actually the song you're hearing in that direction is the same as the song you're hearing in that direction, and that's just an indication there are two territories of robins or great tits or blue tits or whatever. And at that kind of level, I think you just make the whole thing accessible to people who, for most of my early life, would have been intimidated by nature conservation because it was run by people who had big binoculars and knew the Latin names of everything. Mm. And I've never been interested in the kind of train spotting approach to wildlife.
So in your garden, obviously we are absolutely drowned out by the birds here. It's wonderful. But do you actually feed your birds? It always worries me. If you're not there to feed them, do you create the reliance? So do you just let the garden do it for you?
I used to feed the birds year-round, and I've stopped now, partly because of bird flu.
Yeah.
And just concerned that if you start to bring every blue tit in the neighbourhood into your garden, there's much greater risk. And, you know, we've lost the greenfinches here, and there's pretty clear evidence that that's partly because they were congregating and passing on disease to one another.
Yeah.
But also, this is an urban landscape. We have brilliant tawny owls here, but one of the reasons we have brilliant tawny owls is because there's a great rat population in urban Britain.
Oh, a tawny owl will get a rat.
Oh, yeah, tawny owls is their kind of favourite food, I should think.
Yes.
And there's no doubt that actually feeding the birds does attract vermin as well.
Yeah.
So I've eased up on it. And frankly, this neighbourhood is full of natural food for birds, and the garden is as well.
So if you do feed the birds, because a lot of people do, I mean, we do... because pure selfish reasons, we like to see them. We like to sit in the kitchen and see them. And maybe we shouldn't, because there were no trees when we arrived, and I planted like 1,000 tiny trees. And now, obviously, the growth of the trees, the growth of the birds is phenomenal, and hedgerows and things that we've put in, because it was just basically clear farmland. And I do like to feed them, as I said, for my selfish reasons. So we hang up feeders. And then we obviously get the ground feeders who pick up the stuff from the floor. But I do wonder about bird food. I remember I had a German landscape architect working for me maybe 30 years ago. And he said, in Germany, we're very careful. We sterilise everything. We clean everything because of disease and things. And not many people do that over here.
Yeah.
So do you think we are actually causing problems?
Well, I think it's really dangerous to be simplistic about environmental issues generally. I mean, the bird population in urban Britain is very, very much healthier than the bird population in rural, intensively farmed rural England. And so the bird song here in the first thing in the morning is terrific. You'd be hard-pressed to find two pairs of song thrushes within shouting distance of one another if you travelled out into Shropshire or, you know, into Worcestershire. So I think suburban gardens have been phenomenally influential, and we're now beginning to see that they're really significant for bumblebees and for butterflies and a whole range of things. So on the plus side, I think overwhelmingly they bring benefit, and there's no doubt at all that
bird feeders bring benefit.
Well, bird feeders and wildlife gardening and just the general thinking about making your space friendly for birds. And the other thing about bird feeding is the point that you're making, really, that you need to see it. You know, you need to see the wildlife. And I mean, I don't need to see it anymore. But for people who are starting, it's a brilliant way of getting a sense of what's in the neighbourhood.
Mm.
And I think David Attenborough is always quoted as saying that people will never care for wildlife that they've never seen.
Mm.
And it's so important. And actually, I'm working in the wider landscape much more now. And one of the really kind of frustrating things is that you're dealing constantly with people in their 20s and 30s who have never ever walked through a wildflower meadow where the butterflies fly up in front of you. Mm. Well, I had that as a child. I'm hard pressed to find it now in this country anyway. So actually having birds outside your window that you can actually enjoy and recognise and learn about, really important. And the Big Garden Bird Watch, which is this phenomenal citizen science event, this year I think they had 500,000 families sending in their records. So there's a huge interest in not just in enjoying the birds, but also in feeling that in learning about them, you're contributing to a better understanding. Mm. And that's been going for 30 or 40 years now. Mm. So as a kind of way of measuring how things have changed, depressing but really important.
So in a hard winter where there's a water shortage, so then would you put out water for the birds or maybe melt
a little bubbler fountain which doesn't freeze, hasn't frozen so far. So it's a big rock with a hole in it and water bubbles out through the top. And it, certainly in hard weather, it's a stream of birds coming there.
Really?
But actually at this time of year, in early spring, or another 2 or 3 weeks probably, when the first fledglings emerge from the nest, I can sit in my office and look out the window and watch as they queue up for the kind of jacuzzi experience. You know, maybe 15 or 20 blue tits and great tit chicks sitting around it, waiting, and then one by one jumping on the bubbler and bouncing up and down and cleaning their feathers, and then move off and another one will come in.
Oh,
so you don't
amazing.
Need a lot of water to actually make a difference.
Because with our pool, it has a hard edge, I'm afraid, Chris, around it. And they do. You see the woodpeckers going and they can make it. But the little birds, they have to wait really to the lily pads about and things before they can access it. So maybe I should have some little source that like that. It sounds perfect.
Or even, you know, if you know you're in for 2 or 3 days of really hard frost, then actually just putting some water.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in my pond, you can see that there are 2 or 3 rocks just breaking the surface. And actually that's where the birds kind of sit on there and drink.
And
I think it's also it's not so much about access to water for drinking. It's very much in hard weather about keeping their feathers clean.
Mm.
So bathing, you think, God, it's freezing out there. Why is that blackbird splashing around in the freezing cold water? It's because they need to clean the feathers so they'll fluff up properly and give them really good insulation.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
So the pond is really important for
so I'll
for
put
keeping
some
birds
rocks
clean.
In mine in that case, I think, Chris. Thank you for that. And maybe get a bubbler fountain. Most of what you taught me, I have to say, I've really taken on and embraced and everything. The hedgerow bit, I mean, it's so lovely just to pep up the base of a hedgerow, isn't it? Add a few foxgloves and things. Sort of semi-wild gardening that looks beautiful. But I did hear you say, and you might have changed now, but that when you grew courgettes, the slugs ate them all, so you've given up. And so that implied to me that you would not use a slug pellet, albeit organic. Now, we like to be as self-sufficient as we can, meat, veg, fruit, eggs, the lot, in a very smart way, in effect that we don't spend much time on it. And so when I plant my courgette plants, my young plants, I bring the plugs out from the greenhouse, having hardened them off, pop them in, and I watch them like hawks. And as soon as I see that they've got slug holes in, I do put down the odd ferric phosphate thing, and I watch. And if they're, you know, and if they come and eat them all, then I put a few more down. Because I planted my wood, and in the wood, on my onion bed, I could hear in late summer, I could literally hear those slugs which came out from the wood, maybe 10, 15 yards away, and I could hear them chomping on my onions. I mean, there were so many, because they love woodland, don't they? And so I have put my copper pipe down there, and I do put my coffee grinds there, both of which have been scientifically proven to work. But I do need the extra backup. And I think by growing my own fruit, veg and things, I'm helping better if I use a few slug pellets. Mm-hmm. But you obviously decided you wouldn't do that.
Yes, I'm not, because I'm not dependent on the food that I can grow, and I'm not trying to produce an entire diet from my back garden.
But this is choice. That's your choice. It's my choice.
Yes. Sure. But I mean, if everybody was as sophisticated in their decision making as you're describing yourself as, that would be one thing. most people do not make the distinction between one kind of slug pellet and another. And for instance, in my garden, the thing that I really get pleasure from is the raspberries and the red currants and the gooseberries, none of which suffer at all from slugs. Occasional snails will climb up there, and you always think, how on earth did that snail know that if it climbed for 2.5 metres up the raspberry cane, it would actually find something worth eating? Mm. But you know, I just don't try to grow. I grow cut-and-come-again lettuces, but I grow them in boxes right by the first floor balcony front door.
So not many of them trek up there.
That's right. They do occasionally, yes. but actually I then take them back downstairs gently and let them get on with the hostas.
I had a big snail on the bedroom ceiling at one point. I'm amazed how it
got
there.
Oh, I mean, you see them sometimes right up in trees. I mean, 20, lichen. 30 feet high.
Yeah, they love the lichen and the mosses, don't they?
Extraordinary.
Yeah, they are clever. Okay, so then you're not going to tell me off then?
No, I'm not going to tell you off, but I would just say that in the context of what's happened in the UK in my lifetime, the slug pellets, the slug treatment are part of the kind of whole disaster that we've seen. You know, we're now acknowledged formally and officially to be the most nature depleted country in Europe.
Yeah.
The State of Nature report came out just at the end of 2023.
Yeah.
65% decline in farmland birds. And that measure was from 1970 to 2023. My career in conservation started in 1970. Mm. So this is kind of rather depressing to think that despite all of that effort, 65% decline in farmland birds. So when I was growing up, I could walk into fields and lapwings would fly up in front of me. Now, if I see a lapwing, I stop, you know. Mm. It's an extraordinary decline. And the treatment of slugs generally has been a part of that. Now, your garden, my garden, don't make that significant difference. But if you walk through an agricultural crop, I had a walking...
It'd be blue with slug pellets.
Exactly, exactly. So and the water industry is spending millions of pounds taking the slug killer out of the drinking water. Mm. So on a bigger scale...
It's a problem, though, isn't it? Because they're saying that, is it £43 million a year, slugs damage, slugs and sales to rape and wheat?
Mm.
So they're between
and
a rock and a hard
million
place.
A year, I think, the water industry is spending taking the slug pellet residue out of the drinking water.
Yeah.
So it's a distorted kind of situation. And I'm now working a lot with the regenerative farming community, partly because I'm working with the National Grid particularly on trying to restore and rebuild networks of restored habitat through the countryside. Mm. And if you talked, I was talking to a farmer up in East Anglia the other day who had been 6 years ago intensive pig farm, the worst kind of livestock farming, really, you know, the worst things you could do to one of the most sentient creatures on the farm is treat them the way that they're treated in intensive farming.
Have you been to some of the abattoirs at the supermarkets? They are horrific.
Yeah. Anyway, the pig, as you might remember, the pig industry went through a really serious problem. They couldn't get, thanks to Brexit, they couldn't get the butchers and the whole thing collapsed.
Yeah.
So she went out of pigs. She's now been regeneratively farming for 6 years, and and she has a turnover of 2 million. So this is not kind of hobby farming.
Yeah.
But she was just saying the thing she cannot get over is the quality of the bird song on her farm now compared to prior to 6 years ago.
When you say regenerative farming, what is she?
So
doing?
She's livestock grazing, pasture-fed livestock, but focusing particularly on soil and natural fertility.
Yeah.
And the pasture-fed livestock organisation is really interesting. What they're demonstrating all over the country
What's the name again?
Pasture. It's now called
pasture-fed.
Pasture for Life is what the charity's called.
Grass-fed. Yeah.
So these are real farmers. Yeah. These are not the RSPB or the National Trust or anybody else kind of with all of the backup that they've got. These are people who have to make a living growing food. Mm. But what they're doing is realising, I suppose, that if you work with nature rather than against it, what tends to happen, the pattern generally, and there are lots of case studies on their website, but they all basically tell the same story. If you reduce the inputs, then you reduce your turnover, but you increase your profitability, and you gradually make the farm more and more fertile year after year after year.
It's fascinating. I mean, I remember when I was at Reading University doing my Hortic horticulture. They had orchards there which were intensively farmed, and they used to bung on about 30 sprays a year. Mm. And then they stopped. And then the first year after they stopped, the yields were rubbish. And then slowly, as the pests and the things that came in that ate the pests and the whole environment changed, the ecosystem built up. Yep. And they were almost back to where they were. But, yeah, it's fascinating. And people are, I mean, we've got a farmer up in Lincolnshire who's planting rows of orchard trees amongst his grain, tractor width, so he can have meadows and things in the, under yep. the orchard trees between the grain. And he's saying it's producing amazing results. And I think people are getting very creative, thanks to the likes of you, that are making us realise. Just the other thing that I want to take you up on, Chris, sorry about this. I also remember you saying when we were chatting, I don't know, in a lecture or something, and I said, well, I chose landscape architecture because I thought I could combine it with having a family. And you really took me to task on that. I think you thought this is some dilettante who was going to go out there lunching with girls and doing a bit of drawing and something. But I have to say, I took what you said to heart. But I always knew I was pretty committed, which maybe you didn't at that time. And I do think that it is, you know, when I look at all my girlfriends who are medics and they try to combine it with family, they've nearly all given up. And it was such a shame to go through all this. And I do think it is a career that is slightly easier to combine with a family, because we don't have to work like, well, we do, lots of us work 16 hours a day, but you can plan it more when you want it. And maybe because of virus and everything, people are more working from home. But I do think it is a great career for women as well as men. And I hope you didn't think I was going to be a dilettante all my life and just sort of play around.
Well, I've watched you for 45, 50 years now, so I kind of know that that's not the case. I you've got a longer memory than I have.
I'm sure you
do. And
don't,
of course, I was saying insulting things to dozens of students a year. Of course, remember? You, I'm sure they didn't all hang on to those words for the next four decades.
Oh, we do. We take your words to our hearts.
But interestingly, I mean, I had a meeting the other day with four farmers to introduce them to the senior engineers that are dealing with this new infrastructure, electricity infrastructure that they're installing across East Anglia. They were all women.
Really?
All four of the farmers.
Wow.
You know, that, and landscape is full of brilliant women. And interestingly, the work I'm now doing with the National Grid, one of the things that I did was to borrow a copy of the Landscape of Power book,
yeah,
which was written in the 1950s by Sylvia Crowe. So when I was training as a landscape architect, women were completely dominant in the profession. So Brenda Colvin, Sylvia Crowe. And the reason then was actually they couldn't get into architecture. Architecture was so male dominated.
Yeah.
And landscape architecture was the kind of soft option, the kind of almost like flower arranging, but not quite, kind of ghetto. But they moved into that. And apart from Geoffrey Jellicoe, was the only really leading male landscape architect in that generation. All the others were women. So there's a very, very long tradition, I think, of women just working with the land and working with the landscape. And
on the course, there were like three of us, I think, and the rest, other 17, were men when I did it. But it moves around, obviously. But that's interesting, isn't it? The change.
And it was very useful, actually, to be able to look at Sylvia Crowe's book 70 years later. It was written in the 50s, I think, so 70 years later, and just... One of the things I remember I pointed out to the big cheese in the National Grid that I lent the book to was that she was saying all those years ago, lattice pylons are really rather a clever idea because you can see through them, you can see the landscape. And here we are agonising about, can we really cope with lots more lattice pylons through the landscape? And the modern designed T-pylons that were designed as part of a competition a few years ago, I think are pretty hideous. They're white concrete. They look like wind turbine towers without the turbine on the top.
Mm.
And they just stand out in the landscape. And the reason, I think, is that they made that a competition for architects.
And they want to be shown.
Architects wanted everybody to see their product. Landscape architects. I always used to say, I'm sure I said it to your year, good landscape is like good central heating. You know, if it's any good, you don't know you've got it, really.
It's interesting you say about that. So the problem is now with the National Grid, isn't it? Because we were working on a job up in Aberdeen the other day, and they are putting in next to the property massive new pylons, because obviously they've got huge more loads to take around. And what were relatively small pylons, albeit pretty massive, are all going to be taken down, and they're putting in a stretch of massive ones. And they're not telling anyone exactly where they're going. So all those houses in the path feel totally blighted. And it is a problem, isn't it? But I know you are working on putting them underground in certain areas, but that also has its big problems, doesn't it?
You have to be careful what you wish for. I mean, what I've been doing for the last 10 years is chairing this independent advisory board, which has organisations like the National Trust, the Ramblers Association, the Campaign for National Parks on it. And what we were originally briefed to do was to reduce the visual impact of pylons in national parks and areas of outstanding natural beauty. So that's what we've been doing, and we've
Big job.
500 million pound budget.
How many pylons?
Well, so far I think we've removed about 35 or something, but there are many more in the pipeline due to come down. But they've gone, very satisfyingly for me, from beautiful Ridgeway in the Dorset Downs. How anybody ever thought 60 or 70 years ago that putting a line of giant pylons along the skyline was a good idea, who knows? They've gone.
It was the sighting and the size.
Yeah.
And so they've gone underground.
But going underground involved digging a trench 60 metres wide through that landscape.
Because 60 metres wide and how deep?
Only a couple of metres. And then, because you have to put a haul road down the middle of that trench to carry the cables on, because...
60 metres wide?
Yeah.
So for the Americans listening, that's like 180 foot.
Yeah.
Bigger than.
Yeah. It's yeah.
That's bigger than the motorway.
Yeah. It's wider. It's not. It doesn't stay.
It's not there
permanently. So if you now go and look at that stretch of the Dorset Downs, It's all green again. It's all been restored.
What about the trees and the hedges?
Well, in that landscape, there were no trees or hedgerow. It was kind of open farmland. Yeah. But interestingly, in the Peak District, where we've also removed a whole bunch of pylons, we've undergrounded the cable along the old route of the old railway line there, which is a long-distance footpath, Trans-Pennine footpath. But the big concern there was it was a very wooded, steep-sided little valley, not a lot of space to do anything, really. Completely dominated by pylons since the 1950s. And also a really important enclave for the willow tit. The willow tit is just about the most rapidly declining, rarest of our small birds. 90% decline in the last 50 years. We've increased the habitat and increased the population of willow tit in that landscape because we've worked together with the National Grid for 10 years now, and the skill and sensitivity they're able to apply has been just awesome. So
because they've been told how to do it.
Yeah, and they've listened, you know. Yeah. It's all about listening, and my panel have listened to them about the constraints and the difficulties, and between us, they've just done an absolutely brilliant job.
That's brilliant. Because you work for many. I mean, there's so many Wildflower and Wetlands Trust, Waterways Trust, and the youth one. What's one that encourages learning through landscapes, National Heritage Memorial Fund. So many organisations, too many to cite here. But you did. I mean, I thought when I first met you, you know, you'd been on telly, and you were a big, big shout. And I thought you might have gone down the route of someone like Attenborough, Bellamy, Chris Packham and that sort. But because you are an extraordinarily good communicator and you really understand the facts and you pull them out really well, would a life in front of the camera, would you have found it too boring, too frustrating and not been able to do what you've achieved through all the other things you've done there?
I love life in front of the camera. I love making television programmes, and in fact I'm still doing it, but I'm doing it through one of the charities I'm involved with. So I've been president of something called the Thames Estuary Partnership for the last 30 years. In 2019 we made a 1-hour documentary about the living Thames, telling the story of how the Thames, which was dead 70 years ago, is now has harbour porpoises swimming around the House of Commons. I mean, it's an extraordinary good news story.
Yes.
That's gone on to win awards on four continents. I mean, so I'm still doing it. I'm in the middle of making a sequel for that called The Historic Thames, provided the crowdfunding generates the money, telling how the tidal estuary has shaped London for since the last ice age. So I'm still doing all of that. But I did 10 years of TV.
It is quite tedious, isn't it? A lot of the time is spent hanging around, you find.
A huge amount. I did lots of watercolour painting in those 10 years because I was stuck so often just waiting for everybody else.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, I did the very first environmental strand on children's television on a programme that nobody remembers now called Saturday Starship, which was what followed on from Tiswas, which was the one that everybody remembers. And that was...
And Gardener's World, you did Gardener's World.
I did Gardener's World, done it a few times, but in 1979, I made something called the Rich Habitat Garden, and Peter Seabrook was presenting Gardener's World, so he'd only recently taken over from Percy Thrower. That's how long ago this was. Mm. And we did a garden makeover of two adjacent gardens in the new town in Peterborough. Long, long before Alan and the whole garden makeover industry began, and Charlie and all of those
even
guys.
Even pre-John Brooks, probably, just.
Yeah, just about. John Brooks was a contemporary in a way. He was a great inspiration. Yeah. Small Garden was
brilliant designer.
Yeah, great. And in fact, we worked together a bit when I was working in the landscape contracting industry years and years ago.
He got rid of the washing machine garden, as he called it, when people just had pansies around the edge of the garden, like being in a washing machine drum.
But also the room outside was very much his kind of idea that this was another space. Well, here we are sitting in
the
my room
outside.
But the garden that I did for Gardener's World this is 6 years before the Chelsea Wildlife Garden. And I'd been working with Peter Seabrook, on Pebble Mill at One.
Yeah.
And he was doing the orthodox stuff on Pebble Mill at One, which
the
was the kind of lunchtime.
And conifers and window boxes.
And growing vegetables and fruit. Yeah. And I was doing a bit about wildlife garden, but much more about environmental campaigning, a whole range of environmental strands that I was covering. So when it was suggested that Gardener's World should do this garden makeover, he asked me if I'd do one of the two gardens, and the other garden was done by the landscape architect at Peterborough Borough Council. And the other garden was absolutely orthodox, oval lawn, pansies around the edge, kind of classic thing. And mine was a rich habitat garden. And there was a wonderful moment when Peter, in his tie and his jacket, and looking very smart, stepped through the fence to me with my long hair and my beard. And he said,
your loons and T-shirt. No. Was that era?
It was that era, yeah.
Bell-bottoms,
and,
yes.
And he just said, so, Chris, tell me what the idea is behind your garden. And I said, well, I want it to be a family garden, but I want to attract as much wildlife as possible to it. And he just looked at me, all on camera, and he said, and you really think Britain's gardeners are going to be interested in that? It was just an absolute put-down. And I think it's fair to say they were, because there was an absolute avalanche of requests for the leaflet I'd produced for the garden, and that really took Gardener's World by surprise. They thought this was going to be a 1 hour wonder.
Wonderful. Well, let's look at your horticultural skills and go to your back garden.
That won't take long.
No, because you do grow your veg and things, don't you? And it's nice to see how you do that, really. So you do that totally organically, I take it?
Yeah, and I make compost, and we haven't sent our food waste to the food waste centre in Wolverhampton ever.
Where do you put your food waste?
It's in a black compost bin.
Right.
And that then produces all the compost I need for this.
Oh, so you've got an insulated bin.
One of those.
There's a hot
full
box.
Of worms.
There's hot. Oh, it's a wormery.
Yeah, well, it's the way it works. It is a kind of a wormery, but I mean. I'm never quite sure.
Yeah, like a hot box.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Mm.
So that
and
just
you put bittercress in there.
Everything
with its seeds, and that because I always find bittercress, those seeds are really
survive.
Difficult.
Well,
do you find they do in this hot box?
Well,
do you find it kills them?
Well, I mean, I've put that in before the seeds have ripened anyway.
Right.
I wouldn't put them in when they're in full seed. That's full of coarser stuff.
Right.
And then There's another compost bin around here, which is actually almost empty now, but that I put road sweeping leaves into there about 5 years ago. It's now the most perfect fine seed compost. Mm. Quite extraordinary how it's.
And you use that, do you? So it's purely leaf mould.
Yep.
And you use that 100% neat for sowing seeds?
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
And to grow my lettuces in, which I...
Right.
So, yeah. But I mean, it's all very small scale, you know. It's not a very big garden.
When you say that, but this back garden, so is probably twice the size of your front garden. So it's probably, would you say 100 metres? Or not quite?
No. I think it's
50.
About 40 or 50.
40 or 50, but, right.
I mean, from the front gate to the back gate is probably about 70 metres, something like that.
Oh, right. So I'm
not
over-egging it a bit.
Yeah, well,
but you've got an almost topiary bay tree there. Your lovely holly tree. The balcony overlooks this, which is nice.
Yeah, so the kitchen's up there. The kitchen's on the first floor. So that looks down into this garden.
Lovely.
And the living room is on the first floor at the front of the house and looks down into the front garden.
About four raised beds. And you've got lots of lovely curly kale. You've got broccoli is looking amazing, like triffid like, and then you've got a little fruit cage.
And rhubarb, which is, I think,
rhubarb,
you know, no slug worth its salt would even think about eating rhubarb, I don't think. So.
I do find it when I put a forcer over them and you lift them off. When you've got
They're
in there big time, aren't they? Though this is nice, so this is the more horticulture, but you've also got primroses and daffodils.
Well, I can't stop the primroses. I mean, the primroses just are extraordinary for spreading. I didn't plant many of those.
Yeah.
But the ants carry the seeds around.
Yes.
And so there's something on the primrose seed which the ants eat. And so they collect the seeds, they then head off to somewhere else, eat whatever it is on the seed, and then leave the seed behind.
I didn't realise that. So that's why my raised beds have got primroses in as well, which I hoik out and put in the wood or
something. Yeah, I mean, you look at the fruit cage there with the raspberries in it, and it's a carpet of primroses.
Yeah,
I didn't plant one of those.
Beautiful. And you were saying something about gooseberries earlier.
Yeah, there are three gooseberry bushes here, which
could
do with pruning now. But... I just, you can't buy them, or, you know, like for a week, a year, you can sometimes buy gooseberries in Waitrose or Sainsbury's, but generally speaking, I love gooseberry jam.
Yeah.
And probably a couple of times when they're in season, we would have smoked mackerel and gooseberries.
Oh, that's good, yeah.
So, you know, I'm not self-sufficient by even the remotest sense, but I always grow flowers that I can put in salads. So little violas and things, because that, you know, you buy the salad in the supermarket, but then boost it enormously by sprinkling it with flower petals. So at that kind of level.
And it stops the flavours. It makes the flavour seem less bag-like, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it just
exactly.
Adds its own personality.
And lots of herbs, obviously. So quality rather than quantity, I guess, is really what I'm interested in.
But
you were
saying about the gooseberry that a friend of yours at Y did research on them, and he said we are the best. What was it you told me?
Well, he said that the British Isles, the UK, is the best place in the world for growing gooseberries.
Mm.
And I mean, I'm never very sure what the origin of gooseberries are, because they do naturalise back into woodland, and I'm not sure whether it's actually originally a native plant.
They self-seed into my woodland for sure, but I love the red gooseberry, the Rocula is one variety, and they're so sweet and they're so delicious. And we're breeding, everything's really sweet now, which I think is bad for us. The gooseberry's got that nice bit of tartness, which I relish. Chris, it's been fabulous to see your garden. I'm so impressed. And I've been thinking of this garden. It's been in my mind, really, since your book and the slides from you giving us at Birmingham. And it was always an inspiration. And now I see it, it's just lovely. But I bought you, as always, a wee present. And I bought you something which I thought you might like to add to your garden. And it's just an honesty, but it's Lunaria annua Chedglow. So it's an honesty with a purple leaf, but not solid purple usually, and a very vibrant mauve flower. And it seeds around, and I hope you'll enjoy it. And it will just add a touch of purple a bit later on.
And I'll think of you every time. And you can never have too much honesty in your life, can you?
That is very true. Thank you very much, Chris. It's been fab.